Due to the pandemic, blood donations are at an all-time low, which has caused significant issues for hospitalized patients and even postponed elective procedures. Welcome to Modern Practice. I'm your host, Dr. Tom Villanueva. And today we'll talk about shortages in blood supply, and we welcome our guest, Akiba Farber. Akiba, tell us a little bit about your background and your current role here at Vizient.
Sure, Tom. First of all, good morning to everyone, and good morning to you. I am a laboratory med tech by training, then went on to become the laboratory director for the New York Blood Center, and have been doing consulting for the past 26 years. Primarily in the last 12 years, I've been spending my time as senior principal leading our lab blood and dialysis advisory solutions group here at Vizient.
Thank you for joining us. So let's level set. What exactly is going on with the blood supply right now in our country?
Very good question. Unfortunately, the situation is grim. Right now, we have a compromised blood supply throughout our nation. And I'm talking about every blood supplier, not just one of the national blood suppliers like the American Red Cross or Vitalant. We're talking about every local blood supplier, of which there's about 39 of them, as well as the big five that cover the rest of the country. Everyone is finding that the donor population is just exhausted. The many people who donate blood in the past stepped up to donate during our COVID crisis and stepped up to donate convalescent plasma, which was used as a therapy for patients with COVID who were in their early diagnosis stages. So we're calling it COVID-19 donor fatigue, so to speak. And let's remember that only 3% of the nation's population donates blood for the remaining population. So the odds are that you're calling the same donor over and over again to donate either blood or other blood products. In addition, we have a surge now that we've been a bit quiet related to COVID-19, though we know their variant is kicking up. The utilization has gone up because many people have postponed surgery and are now coming back to the hospital to see their physicians and getting surgery. So when utilization goes up and supply goes down, you've got a crisis. And that's exactly what's happening today.
So I can understand that. That makes sense to me. But were there other issues involved prior, even that exacerbated during the pandemic as well, that caused the shortage?
Yes, that's a good question. The answer is that every so often, and it's been frequent of late, the FDA will be issuing and continues to issue additional guidelines to protect the safety and efficacy of the unit of blood and to protect the donor as well. So with the increased number of tests and the increased guidelines, we are finding that even historical donors who have donated in the past are being eliminated. So that 3% is being reduced. At the same time, we are trying to recruit new donors, and that is a big expense and a big ask, because I'm sure this audience and others are aware that maybe perhaps open my wallet and donate money, but to roll up my sleeve and have a needle put into my arm for as little as 20 minutes or as much as 90 minutes is uncomfortable, I'm afraid, and therefore many people shrivel away from donating blood, or they find it inconvenient because it's too much time.
And I can understand that as well. So during this podcast, we've actually mentioned how the pandemic brought up many of our country's dirty little secrets, if you can, and when it comes to the healthcare industry. Is how we attain blood and how we use blood part of one of those dirty little secrets that have been exposed?
Let me just expose some things that have been going on for a while. Despite efforts, we've never really focused and understood what does it take to recruit a new donor. Besides education, besides presentation, besides explaining that the needle is disposable and it's safe, besides making it more and more convenient, we've never really made an exerted effort to educate as a whole. And we don't have a true incentive, in my opinion, that incentivizes donors to step forward. Historically, we used to give them cookies and coffee. Today, we don't give coffee. We do give cookies. We give other types of refreshments and drink to replenish the volume of blood that they've lost. But there is not a true incentive. There were discussions about giving some type of gift that was perhaps exchanged as cash redeemable. We are doing that today. We're giving $5 gift certificates or $10 gift certificates. But the FDA has always shied about that. And even today, does a $5 gift certificate incent anyone to donate blood? I really believe we have to take a hard look at how do we incentivize and how do we educate. The dollars being spent to recruit a new donor are almost near the same cost cost that it costs to test a unit of blood. And that shouldn't be the case.
So we've mentioned that about maybe only 3% of the population donates. And among them, we actually have some donor fatigue going on. You put on there that in addition to that, there is actually more elective procedures going on that require blood. And then there is a lack of incentivization to actually recruit new donors. Is another problem is that we're just using way too much blood in our country? I mean, how do we compare to other parts of the world?
Okay, so that is also an interesting point, and it is true that we in the years past have had a plentiful supply of product, plentiful in that the blood programs have continued to grow their capabilities to collect, and they have focused on reducing their costs as well. But that was years past when there were fewer tests and fewer guidelines that restricted donors. And quite frankly, the older population understood or grew up with the mentality that donating blood is necessary. The younger population is learning now and becoming more acclimated, and they are stepping up. But what is happening at the hospital level is many of the clinicians continue to practice with the thought that when the hemoglobin, member of oxygen-carrying red cells, is a certain point in your body, there should be transfusions to address it. And quite frankly, everyone who understands the body understands that blood begets blood. When you transfuse blood, you're sending a message to the immune system saying we have adequate amount of blood, we do not need to produce more red cells. So you've actually now causing the patient to be dependent on more red cells. The guidelines, which was the magical hemoglobin, the number set is just a number, and it is a good number, but it's not the absolute value that should determine whether or not a patient should be transfused. So quite frankly, many hospitals in the past 3 to 5 years have been focused on determining whether or not transfusion is indicated beyond just looking at a number, but rather looking at the stability of the patient and looking at transfusion alternatives. That is the proper way to transfuse. There are different countries in our world, and there are different parts of our own country where the academic medical centers and even the community blood centers have begun to recognize, based on product supply shortages, that they need to reassess patients more carefully and they need to avoid transfusions. And we all know that transfusions comes with risks. They're in essence a transplant. So there are viruses that can be transmitted by blood, and there are a host of other costs associated with transfusion and medical ramifications.
Next to do no harm, the other thing that was embedded in me in med school was treat the patient and not the number. How do organizations that use a more restrictive blood transfusion program come out in their outcomes versus those that use a liberal?
The answer is, interestingly enough, as we would hope, the patients do better. The lengths of stay are shorter. Their patients get up and get out of bed quicker. As I mentioned earlier, their body will react to their lower hemoglobin and will build them back up. And the transfusion alternatives that I won't go into all of them, but many of the transfusion alternatives will get them back to their normal hemoglobin, get them back up. And therefore, at the end of the day, they will be able to be discharged earlier. And the costs associated with the additional length of stay, the costs associated with the transfusions and the testing, the cost of monitoring that transfusion and ensuring that there is no adverse effects, all of those are downstream positive effects of avoiding transfusion. But most importantly, patient outcomes are demonstrated that they do better and they get out of the hospital or discharged earlier.
What data do we have at Vizient to support these insights?
So interestingly enough, in order to support it, we felt, and being an analytics company and a consulting group, we relied on analytics and we rely on data gathering. So what is not available in the past from many of our blood bank information technologies are accurate reports by service or by clinician that actually tell us how they're doing in terms of their transfusions, how their patients are doing. But we now took that data gathering tool and we put it on steroids. We now have developed a system that allows us to review charts, random charts by MS-DRG, and allows us to look at how the patient was managed from the time that they were admitted to the time that they were fortunately discharged, and determine what we could have done better as it relates to transfusion. Could we have avoided all transfusions? Could we have limited the number of transfusions? And what methodologies could we have used and what transfusion alternatives can we have used. And some of those are pharmaceuticals and some of those are technology that allows us, for example, to salvage shed blood at the wound site. And once we wash it, return it to the patient without the patient receiving a homologous unit. In other words, a volunteer donor. Their autologous blood is their own blood. So they'll be receiving their own blood back again. And that is the best alternative to transfusion. So those technologies and that ability to review charts is giving us the ability then to not only view how often we could avoid transfusion, but we can bring this and we can test our clinicians and heighten their awareness as to how this patient was managed and how best to manage this patient. Interestingly enough, though we blind it because we do not want to chastise any of our clinicians, we can actually show a clinician their own patient and their patient's chart and have them weigh in as to how they managed it in the past and how they would manage it today using strategies that we hope to educate them on and or have them rethink how they manage and how they managed in the past. So we're trying to leap forward in them rethinking how they manage today and how they will manage in the future. We're driving clinical change using this methodology.
By data. That's fantastic. And I can't wait to actually go into some more detail in the next two episodes. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode. I want to thank Akiba Faber for joining us. If you'd like to contact Akiba, we put his email address on the resource section of our podcast page. We'll return next week to continue our discussion. If you have any additional questions pertaining to modern practice or even want to contact me, please contact us also at our email at modernpracticepodcast@vizientinc.com. It's also available on the resource page. And please join us for other Modern Practice Podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. Subscribe today, like us, or send us your comments. Also listen to and subscribe to SG2 Perspectives, the podcast and the latest in healthcare strategies. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thanks for listening.